Welcome to Silicon Bites episode 40. In this episode, we are going to look in more detail at the Crocus City Hall attack and why it may be just the first in a wave of terror incidents, terror and catastrophes that could potentially sweep Russia this year while it is still engaged with full-scale war against Ukraine. Before we do that, let's catch up with some of the headlines, some of the latest progress made by Ukraine on the front lines. And this story just breaking from the Kyiv Independent, Ukraine reportedly hits aviation training center in Russia's Voronezh Oblast. And this is dated yesterday, 9th of April. Ukrainian drones attacked a Russian aviation training center in the city of Borisoglebsk in Russia's Voronezh Oblast overnight on April the 9th, a representative of Ukraine's military intelligence announced. As usual, Ukrainian intelligence did not disclose any details, but there is speculation about the target and the importance of the hit. As Ukraine continues to hit Russian infrastructure and to take out Russian planes on the ground, it is only logical that they would extend the attacks to training centers to prevent the next generation of pilots being trained up to attack and kill Ukrainians. And talking of aircraft losses, again from the Kyiv Independent, this is a story from a couple of days ago, April the 7th. Russia reportedly loses seven aircraft to a Ukrainian drone attack. Russia allegedly lost seven important military aircraft during Ukraine's April the 5th drone attacks on the Yeysk Air Base in Krasnodar Krai in Russia. Again, a source close to Ukraine's military intelligence told the Kyiv Independent. Ukrainian forces attacked three Russian airfields with unidentified drones. The intelligence source said the Ukrainian drone attack damaged four Russian Sukhoi 30SM fighter jets, two transport aircraft, and one Beriev BE-200 Altair. That last jet may not be something you have heard of before, as I'm not familiar with it, but it is a jet-powered amphibious flying boat designed for firefighting, search and rescue operations, and maritime patrol, as well as freight and passenger transportation. And this is just one of many Ukrainian strikes over the last couple of weeks that target Russian military and industrial objectives. And Ukraine has been using domestically produced long-range drones in these highly successful attacks, including against oil refining and weapon production facilities. This has prompted Russia to announce increased air defense efforts in those areas. But of course, Russia has hundreds of potential targets, if not thousands, covering its mainland regions. And now these drones are able to reach at least 1,500 kilometers. That brings many of the most important facilities well within the range of Ukrainian strikes. And of course, Russia simply does not have the air defense systems to protect all of these places. And as Ukraine extends its successful campaign of hitting back against Russia, of trying to blunt Russia's war machine, trying to prevent its capabilities to strike Ukraine and kill civilians, in America, it seems on both sides of the political fence, alternative and much weaker plans are forming. One are the private comments of former US President Donald Trump and, of course, a candidate in the upcoming race who has apparently said that he could end Russia's war by pressuring Ukraine to cede Crimea and Donbass to Moscow. And these comments have been expressed also by Viktor Orban, who is rumored to be fulfilling the role as a kind of go-between in passing communications between the Kremlin and Donald Trump's team. This idea to cede territory for apparent peace has been labeled as simplistic and naive by Zelensky, and I think all Ukrainians will see it as such. The presumptive Republican nominee has also reportedly said that he thinks Moscow and Kiev want to save face and want a way out of the conflict. That, again, anyone who's been following this channel, anyone who knows anything about Putin's mindset and indeed Russian history will know that that idea is hopelessly naive. Kiev doesn't want to save face. It wants to save its people, save its land, save its language, save its culture from a genocidal assault by Russia. Is Russia looking to save face because somehow it values the lives of its citizens? Absolutely not. Putin has converted his economy into a war economy, and his regime depends on perpetual warfare in order to survive and clamp down on dissenters. The idea of saving face is something that was talked about in the first months of the war. To bring that up again 2 years in, frankly, is grotesquely ignorant and dangerous. And here is a long piece in the Kyiv Independent about how Russia's strikes against the Engels Air Base can change the dynamic of the war. Russia's Engels Air Base has once again come under attack on April the 5th after what sources in the military intelligence claimed was a drone strike. Russia's Engels Air Base has once again come under attack on April the 5th after military intelligence sources have claimed was a drone strike on one of the Kremlin's most strategically important military installations. And we have to remember, this is deep inside Russian territory. According to the source in military intelligence, who, as usual, wanted to remain anonymous, Ukraine successfully hit the Engels 2 airbase located in Russia's Saratov Oblast, located over 750 kilometers away from the nearest Ukrainian-controlled border. And these are strategic bombers used to attack the country with a variety of air-launched cruise missiles. According to that same source, 7 people were killed or injured, among them aircraft pilots. And whereas Russia may be profligate with its ground troops, it's unlikely that it has an endless supply of trained and skilled pilots. So this is an important success by Ukraine. The Engels military airbase is amongst the most important Russian military sites and is regularly used for the country's attacks on Ukraine. It is also now a prized target for Ukraine as well. And to continue the other side of the critique of US policy, whereas Trump's policy seems to be misguided and dangerous, it is perhaps no less so the one that we see being followed by the Biden government. And we have here the Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin, who has come out and said attacks by the armed forces of Ukraine on Russian refineries could negatively affect the global fuel and energy complex. It is better for Ukraine to strike those targets that directly affect the course of hostilities and meet the tactical needs of the Ukrainian armed forces. That is, Ukraine's policy is working. Ukraine's policy of hitting Russian refineries, hitting their fuel refining capacity, their logistics, hitting their air bases, hitting the places from which those deadly attacks are launched is really hurting Russia. Russia goes and squeals to its various allies around the world. It may even have gone to squeal to the US as well. And the comments coming out of the US are now voicing what quite possibly has been the subtext all along. They are absolutely disgraceful comments, suggesting that Ukraine, following a winning strategy to protect its citizens, to protect them from a genocidal assault, is somehow putting the re-election of a Democrat candidate in the forthcoming election at risk by potentially influencing global energy prices. How dare they? How dare they defend their people? How dare they win the war in such an underhand manner? The tone and implication of these comments is absolutely appalling. But as I say, I think it sheds a light on what has been the strategy all along, which is to not enable Ukraine to achieve a decisive victory over Russia. Because better the devil you know. Even if that devil is a tyrant, a genocidal killer, and one that is intent on destroying not just democracy in Ukraine, but undermining the very concept of democracy around the world, don't fight against that if it influences global fuel prices. It's a weak, myopic policy that completely lacks vision, leadership, and imagination of any kind, and unfortunately, these views are likely shared by many leading people and many advisors within the Biden administration. And that assault by Russia continues. Here's a story from the 6th of April, 4 killed, 23 injured in Russian attacks on Zaporizhia. The death toll of Russian missile attacks against Zaporizhia on the afternoon of April the 5th has risen to 4, the governor of the local region stated, and 23 people were injured. Victims include 2 men, 2 women, and caused widespread destruction. More than 40 buildings were damaged, including 24 houses, 9 multi-story buildings, a dormitory, and a kindergarten. This is an area with a population of around 710,000, and it emphasizes that these kind of attacks by Russia are entirely focused on the civilian population. They are entirely designed to cause terror and injury and serve little to no military purpose. And these attacks happen day in, day out, week after week, to the point where they seem to have become normalized and largely ignored in the mainstream media. These headlines do sometimes get through, and here's one that again focuses on Zaporizhia, but this time it's a drone attack against the nuclear plant, which has once again been struck. Kiev has downed dozens of Vladimir Putin's drones and 2 guided missiles as Ukraine was accused of hitting a Russian-controlled nuclear power plant. Of course, Ukraine has hit back and has said that they strenuously avoid trying to do that. And of course, putting nuclear facilities in danger is a strategy that we have seen before and throughout this conflict adopted by Russia. So it is entirely plausible that they would try to do this to once again remind the world what they are capable of doing, remind the world that they are not averse to adopting ecocide as a weapon of war, as we saw in the destruction of the Kakhovka Dam. Meanwhile, Ukraine has revealed it is developing unstoppable AI-powered drones in a push to create image recognition targeting systems to get around the electronic warfare and hunt for targets, especially behind Russian lines and in Russian territory. And this facility is incredibly important, much more important if you're considering these drones have to travel several hundred or up to 1,500 to 2,000 kilometers to reach their targets. If Ukraine can develop this technology and then manufacture it at scale, it provides them with significant capabilities in resisting occupation by the Russian forces. Also covered in the Kyiv Independent is the speculation that a Russian counteroffensive could start in May or June, and Kharkiv is likely to be targeted. We see, of course, in Russia's actions to try and take out the air defenses, to try and take out the energy capacity of Kharkiv, to threaten that city, Ukraine's second largest city, with annihilation, is quite possibly the early stages of an attempt to take it and give Vladimir Putin some kind of victory that he can take to his people before potentially trying to freeze the lines of contact later in the year. And of course, the timing is no coincidence. They need to achieve this before Trump gets in, potentially, to the role of president. And then they could use him to try and broker some kind of land for peace deal, but only after they have a victory that they can brag to their people about. And why is it important for Russia to accelerate? Not because it is strong, victorious, and inevitable, but because its losses are piling up in an unbelievable way. Here, the Kyiv Independent estimates that Russia has lost 446,000 troops in Ukraine, which is many, many times more its losses in Afghanistan, Chechnya, or any similar conflict since the Second World War. And on top of that loss of personnel, Russia reportedly has also lost over 7,000 tanks, over 13,000 armoured vehicles, almost 15,000 other types of vehicles and fuel tankers, 11,000 artillery systems, 1,000 multiple rocket launchers, 749 air defence systems, 347 planes, 325 helicopters, 8,800 drones, 26 ships and boats, and one submarine. This is a staggering scale of losses to essentially push their lines of control not very far beyond what they actually had achieved in the 2014 to 2022 incursions into Ukraine. It is incredibly embarrassing for an apparent superpower to sustain these losses with so little to show for it. And there's a fascinating video here I'm going to put a link with. It's on the Kyiv Post, but it is with Chuck Farah, who analyzes the chaos on the Russian lines. He breaks into these figures of the staggering losses, but also analyzes what he calls the increasing mayhem that are rocking the Russian army. And indeed, I see many, many videos in Russian that talk about the high rates of desertion, demoralization, and the increasing use of terror by Russian officers to force their soldiers to fight. Chuck Farr, hopefully, will be coming on the channel soon. He is a former squad leader of SEAL Team 6 and explains why Russia, despite having substantially more troops than Ukraine, even now, is failing to make significant territorial gains. He talks about the multitude of striking indications that Russia has neither the strategic nor the tactical ability to execute complex missions. And this is really important because even if Russia was to break through Ukrainian lines, it's highly likely that if they were to dig deeper into Ukraine, those advances would very quickly fall apart due to their inability to master combined arms and because of their very vertical approach to organizing and managing troops. That means there'll be very little initiative on the ground. And as those soldiers move beyond their logistics lines, beyond their lines of communication, it's likely they will descend into some kind of chaos and then lose any territory they might gain. So when you see some analysts and media going into a frenzy about Russia potentially taking over the whole of Ukraine, it does seem incredibly unlikely when you actually look at Russia's capability and its tactics. And how's Russia making up for this? Well, this article in the Kyiv Independent suggests how they aim to do it, and it's likely to fail just like their first round of mobilization failed. And that is that Russia aims to recruit 400,000 contract service personnel in the current year. This is to sustain its forces in Ukraine after severe losses in the all-out war. Now, this is based on analysis done by the UK's Defence Ministry, and it's an intelligence report published on April the 10th. This mobilization step also aims to support Russia's plans to increase the size of its forces to 1.32 million personnel this year and 1.5 million subsequently, the report states. Ukraine's military intelligence said earlier that Russia is likely to ramp up its mobilization efforts after President Vladimir Putin has secured his fifth term in office. Of course, that almost makes it sound like a genuine election process. It is more of a formality, of course, as you'll know from watching videos on this channel. President Volodymyr Zelensky has also come out and talked about this topic. He has said that Russia is planning to mobilize at least 300,000 soldiers by June the 1st, but he later clarified that pronouncement, saying that that number is not final. Of course, after June, there is still half the year to go, and Russia likely will continue rounds of mobilization or conscription, as well as increase the number of contract soldiers if it is able to do so. Now, there are some subtle differences, the report states. Conscripts are employed in garrisons across Russia, and they generally form battalions that are separate from the battalions staffed by contract soldiers. Some of the conscripts are likely to serve near Ukraine's border in units providing border security. The conscript soldiers commonly face pressure, however, to sign contracts and therefore become liable to serve in Ukraine. There is likely reluctance among the Russian authorities to risk combat casualties among conscript soldiers. This would be extremely unpopular, the UK Defence Ministry states. Casualties amongst volunteer soldiers are more tolerated by society, as are casualties amongst those who have signed contracts in order to serve for money. Now, before we turn to the Moscow Crocus City Hall attack, which forms the main theme of this episode, let's look at another interesting story. And this is one that really should get a lot more traction, especially across the US, where Russia has been able to use the Orthodox Church as a key part of its propaganda. But in reality, this article states, faith is under fire. Russia is conducting a war on religion in Ukraine's occupied territories. Russia's war and occupation of large swathes of Ukraine, says the article, has led to hundreds of churches being damaged or destroyed, dozens of priests killed or kidnapped, and entire religious groups that don't conform to Moscow's brand of orthodoxy being banned. And of course, we know a lot worse happens. With entire Ukrainian cities being leveled by Russian artillery, religious sites are caught in the crossfire, and Russia has shown complete disregard for either civilian damage or damage to churches. They are simply seen as collateral. However, attacks against Ukrainian priests, religious sites, and of course, minority religions, especially Protestant religions, are not arbitrary. The Kremlin is weaponizing religion and using it as a tool for control and propaganda. Entire religious groups in the Russian-occupied parts of the country have been repressed, or as in the case of the Greek Catholic Church in occupied parts of the Zaporizhia Oblast, completely banned. Parishes of the Orthodox Church of Ukraine have disappeared completely as well from occupied areas. This behavior, the article states, is characteristic of Russia's relationship with genuine religious organizations. Moscow practices a strict hierarchical model of state-church relations, the article explains, that promotes dominance of traditional government-controlled groups like the Russian Orthodox Church and seeks to expunge any religious organization that is genuinely organic and does not come under state control. Moscow's suppression and absorption of Ukrainian religious life confirms its intention not only to occupy Ukraine's territory, but to eliminate Ukrainian religious structures and replace them with Russian ones under the control of the FSB in order to fully integrate them into the Russian space and the Russian world. And just as Russia has established terror and repression on the occupied territories, it seems that terror and repression is ramping up on the territories of Russia itself. The Moscow shooting in the Crocus City Hall, explains the Kiev Independent, is now resulting in repressions, racism, and terror. And it does seem that that shooting is going to be used as the justification for a new wave of massive terror and repression in Russia itself. Russian politicians and propagandists began calling for reinstating the death penalty, a mechanism that can be used not only against terrorists, but also against the peaceful opposition. And there's no point in even talking about miscarriages of justice or potential issues. There is no justice in Moscow. The only force that matters is power and the will of power. So if they want to frame somebody for a crime, whether that is a criminal offence or whether it is something to do with a political offence, they will find a reason one way or another to put those labels on a defendant. And then it is not just their liberty they could lose or their health, they could be losing their lives as well. Furthermore, a new wave of xenophobia has spread across the country after it was revealed that the perpetrators of the attack were from Tajikistan, a Central Asian country bordering on Afghanistan. Millions of Central Asian migrants, primarily from Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan, work in Russia in construction and retail. Cases of attacks and harassment from ordinary citizens, as well as the state authorities, have been recorded en masse since the Moscow terror attacks. The atmosphere of state terror is increasing in Russia, said Sergei Sasonov, a Russian-born political philosopher who is working and residing in New York. The political atmosphere is becoming far more savage, he said. And there are many theories as well as to how this Moscow terror attack happened. Here is an interesting one in the New York Post by Mark Toth and Jonathan Sweet, writers and analysts who have appeared on Silicon Curtain last year. Despite the fact that ISIS have claimed clear responsibility for the concert shootings that killed 133 and injured 140, the Kremlin is seeking to put the blame on Ukraine. The now gutted concert hall venue is only 14 miles from the Kremlin and from the FSB's headquarters at the Lubyanka. There has been many eyebrows raised about how the attack not only was allowed to happen in the first place, but how the attack carried on for so long before any security presence appeared on the ground. In fact, the terrorists had long fled the scene before security forces entered the building. And of course, speculation is rife because if we think back to September 1999, Russia experienced similar terrorist outrages when four bombings took place, one of them in a Moscow neighborhood and another in Volgodonsk. The then Prime Minister, a certain Vladimir Putin, exploited the attacks, which killed nearly 307 Russian citizens in order to justify a second invasion of Chechnya and, of course, entrench his position in power. That was a significant event that laid the foundations for his presidential administration and the landslide elections that were to follow. This has, of course, led to some speculation that as his regime starts to come under increasing pressure, that there has been a reversion to these tactics in order to ramp up terror, and for other reasons. Another reason, of course, could be that these terror attacks were either initiated or more likely allowed to happen in order to justify the full-scale mobilization, something which Putin has notably held off from doing, when quite possibly his military advisors have been supporting such a move for some time, because it comes with considerable risk. So ramping up the security situation in the country, and by that I don't mean guarding against foreign attacks, but making sure you have full control over hearts and minds and keeping your own population in a state of nervous terror would make sense. But there are other ideas here as well. There is reputed to be a significant pro-war faction within the administration, and there are many people potentially in senior positions in Russia and even within the oligarch class that are not so hawkish when it comes to the war. They could be loosely labeled as people who are not anti-war, but those who want to see the so-called special military operation tapering down before it does further damage to their interests and to the overall Russian economy. If a tussle is genuinely going on behind the scenes between different camps, it is also possible that the door was left open for this attack by a particularly hawkish faction within the FSB in order to force a vacillating and indecisive Putin to go for full mobilization and try to scale up the war, essentially slamming the door on peace. And of course, as has been stated, Washington did give advanced warnings of a terrorist outrage and made those public to ensure that the Kremlin could not spin those as lies later on. It's significant that it does not seem those were acted upon. It does not seem that security was tightened in key positions in Moscow, such as the concert hall. And this really leads to a fevered and tricky debate as to whether the attacks are part of a plot or whether they are part of some institutional incompetence. Now, of course, given Russia's history, given what we know about how the regime works, both are plausible. Extreme incompetence based on nepotism, corruption, and laziness is absolutely a feature of this regime. But so too is terror. Terror, the like of which it is difficult for us, I think, in the West to imagine. And back to the title of the episode, why should we fear this as being the first in a wave of attacks? Because if it was accidental, then it's likely that other attacks can break through. We have seen that the security forces are utterly incompetent. They are built around repressing their internal population, not around establishing security in the country. That leaves Russia open to similar attacks. That's one theory. Another theory that if it is a faction within the pro-war grouping, then we may well see many more of these attacks as they try to ramp up and put pressure on the regime to increase its assault upon Ukraine, if that is indeed possible. If the authorities themselves, Putin's regime, had a hand in the attacks, under that scenario, of course, we would see this trick being used again and again in order for Putin to exert control over his people. So none of these three scenarios are particularly optimistic. None of them lead to a peaceful outcome. All of them hold the door open for many more terror attacks potentially to occur on the territory of Russia over the coming months. And we have to note as well that Russia is increasingly becoming a society defined by violence. The Moscow Times reports that by torturing the Moscow attack suspects, Russia risks radicalizing future terrorists. And of course, this plays into one of the scenarios that we outlined. Shortly after Russian law enforcement captured the four suspects of the Kroker City Hall terror attack, images indicating that they had been tortured surfaced for the whole world to see. To the joy of many pro-war and ultra-nationalist social media channels, a video of one of the suspects having his ear severed and being forced to put it in his mouth had surfaced. Another suspect was pictured lying down with his jeans lowered and being electrocuted. By the time all four suspects appeared in court for the trial and were found guilty 2 days later, it was obvious that all of them had undergone some level of brutalization since their capture. Traditionally, and even under Stalin's regime, such images were not made public. Those who had undergone vicious processes were cleaned up, tidied up before they were forced in front of cameras. In this instance, neither Russian authorities nor law enforcement seemed to care. In fact, they revel in the brutality, in the impunity with which they can act. This does not bode well for the future at all. And as the Moscow Times goes on to speculate, Russia is descending into the dark ages through the normalization of violence. When agents of the Russian state publish such things, they are essentially giving a green light for others to perform such acts. Even though their violence is directed at suspected terrorists, it's the proud demonstration that shows everyone that the state has complete power over human life through law enforcement. Humans are reduced to their physical bodies that can be destroyed, tortured, humiliated, often gleefully and theatrically, says the Moscow Times. No longer conducted in secret, violence is made public. It is celebrated and enjoyed. Torture, we know, has been used by the Russian police, the FSB, and prison authorities before. In recent years, however, evidence has emerged that this is widespread, including the use of rape, the threat of it as well by prison officials against male prisoners, and the state has embraced the worst practices of traditional Russian prison subculture with the violent denigration of the downtrodden and those who are powerless. But despite the leaked videos of violence and torture, This has, until now, been largely kept out of public sight. There has been an element, perhaps, of concern if these got into the media around the world. It seems that those kind of limitations, those concerns, no longer apply. The torturers who happily smile for the benefit of the camera record their atrocities, and these images are, without restriction or condemnation, given over to the press for public consumption. State security personnel themselves have been distributing these videos, and it seems there are no repercussions. Again, based on our theories of how terror, mayhem, trauma are going to be escalating within Russia, this is a clear sign that law enforcement has impunity. If they inflict these horrors on terrorist suspects today, you can be certain they'll be inflicting it upon anyone who opposes the regime tomorrow. And of course, these images and videos have instilled fear amongst Central Asian migrants living in Russia. And as we mentioned, those conditions seem to have got substantially worse for anyone who is clearly not of ethnic Russian origin. And this terror also shines a light on the fact that law enforcement, this vast Siloviki class in Russia, is not trained, built, and structured in order to target real criminals, but is there to target citizens and to protect the Kremlin from its own people. In this context as well, the potential reintroduction of the death penalty by the state, of course, is terrifying because, as we know, it will not be used as an instrument of law enforcement against genuine criminals. It will be used against anyone seeking to challenge the primacy of the Kremlin and the state. And some of the sentences people are getting for the most minor of misdemeanors are getting even more absurd. The Moscow Times reports that a Russian blogger got 10 months correctional labor for tickling a statue. The Russian blogger was sentenced to 12 months of correctional labor for rehabilitating Nazism by posting an Instagram video where she pretends to tickle a World War II monument. Authorities detained Alyona Agafonova in February, months after the pro-Kremlin bloggers drew attention to a video in which she recorded herself wiggling her finger under the breasts of the Motherland Calls statue in the city of Volgograd. The Volgograd Regional Court found the young woman guilty of rehabilitating Nazism, according to a statement on its Telegram channel. And here's a couple of quick stories, which I think we will follow up on in subsequent episodes of Silicon Bites, because they may well show the future direction of travel for Russian aggression. One is from the defenseblog.com, which talks about leaked audio that reveals Russia's plans to occupy Kazakhstan territory. This leaked audio recording from a Russian deputy has sent shockwaves through diplomatic circles, apparently indicating that Kazakhstan could be the next target of Russian aggression following Ukraine's invasion. This is something actually we talked about in a Silicon Bites a couple of weeks ago, that if Russia fails to take more Ukrainian territory, if it fails to reach any of its propaganda and military goals in Ukraine, it may well turn to other softer targets in order to continue its perpetual warfare and to gain more resources, both human and material resources, in order to replenish its military supplies and get new bodies with which to progress its imperial agenda. The leaked recording, initially shared with parliamentary defense committees, surfaced publicly last Saturday, sparking concerns over Kazakhstan's security. Gorilov attributes Russia's military buildup against Kazakhstan to what he describes as the country's failure to comply with Kremlin directives. He claims that decisions have already been made regarding Kazakhstan's fate. The disclosure comes amid a backdrop of escalating tensions, with Russian media increasingly demonizing Kazakhstan mirroring the rhetoric that's been used against Ukraine in previous years. Well, this is a terrifying read, of course, but it is perhaps not totally unexpected. Another interesting story is from Euromaidan Press, and it is about the expulsion of Russians who have now been proven to be spies from NATO HQ. Many people on Twitter, of course, arguing why were there Russians present in the NATO administrative headquarters 2 years in to Russia's full-scale assault on Ukraine. It's the mind almost boggles at the thought that these were not seen as a risk. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg mentions the expulsion of Russian personnel from NATO headquarters for engaging in espionage rather than diplomatic activities, but did not specify when it occurred. He said, "We have seen that Russian intelligence services have operated across European countries for many years. We're also seeing attempts to step up their activities, but of course the NATO allies are monitoring, following this very closely." Monitoring, yes, but still allowing Russian personnel to operate within NATO headquarters is absolutely remarkable. It also perhaps sends a signal to Moscow about how unserious we are about our own security. And the final two stories are perhaps a little more positive. This one, "Finland extends Russia's border closure indefinitely," reports the Kyiv Post. Finland has accused Moscow of weaponizing migration across the Nordic nation, an assertion which, of course, the Kremlin denies, but the Kremlin always lies, as we know. Finland will indefinitely extend the closure of the land border crossing with Russia and has added several ports to a list where travel from its eastern neighbour is prohibited, the government said on Thursday, April the 4th. Well, in contrast to the slow-moving decisions by NATO, this seems to be an incredibly sensible measure by Finland. Finland understands the threat from Russia, and it takes measures not to tick a box, but it takes measures to genuinely guard its security, and these must, of course, be lauded. And finally, Estonia, that hero nation, again, who absolutely understand the threat from Russia, has reportedly found another million shells from Ukraine. That's half the artillery ammunition Ukrainian gunners need for the rest of 2024, reports Forbes. 7 weeks after the Czech defense policy chief Jan Gieris announced his government had identified 800,000 and later a million artillery shells that Ukraine's allies could buy for Ukraine, Estonian defense minister Hanno Pevkur said that his own government had found another million shells and rockets for Ukraine. Now, these are incredible initiatives, but they really do beg the question, if smaller nations like these can actually achieve such incredible feats to support Ukraine, why cannot the larger economies in the EU and the US do the same? It seems that they have the will for Ukraine to succeed, to survive, and a concept of why Ukrainian victory is important, whereas others, especially in Berlin and Washington, seem to have no such concept or indeed sense of urgency. And it's interesting in the last week that the British Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, has started talking with the same language as the Czechs, Estonians, about why Ukrainian victory is so important. We do not yet see, however, those words reflected in the recent UK budget, where there has been no significant uptick on spend with the military. It seems like we need to get a lot more serious. We need to mirror the behaviour of Estonia and the Czech Republic in gathering equipment, munitions, capabilities to help Ukraine win. Not just do the minimum in order to tick a box and satisfy internal administrative or electoral processes. Things need to change, and Estonia and the Czech Republic are shining the way which we really need to follow with a greater sense of urgency if Ukraine is to triumph in this war and beat back Russian aggression and imperial ambitions. If Europe does not get serious, we may see the terror and horror that is sweeping Russia and territories under Russian control come far close to home on the European continent.